Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Just when you thought you had all the financial vocabulary down, there is another one to learn. Add putbacks to CDOs and credit default swaps, gang. Why the foreclosure mess might really hurt. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It's Tuesday, today the 19th of October. Good to have you with us. It's a rare thing indeed when the biggest bank in the country reports a $7 billion loss, and that's not the lead story of the day. But such is the state of the financial industry that Bank of America's earnings announcement this morning is playing second banana. Of more interest and importance, probably, is the ever-growing discussion of how bad the foreclosure mess might eventually get. The marketplace word of this Tuesday is putback. It's the present-day corollary to collateralized debt obligation and credit default swap of a couple of years ago, neither of which, by the way, wound up meaning anything good for the banking industry. We've got our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, here with us to explain. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Kai.
All right. Putbacks. What are they? Why do they matter?
Well, first of all, you're turning a transitive verb into a noun, okay? But here's what the dictionary says. Okay. Return something to where it belongs is the first definition. And the second is probably more appropriate here. Pay something back to a person or group.
Or refund.
Exactly. Remember we've talked about these mortgage-backed securities that were sold to investors, either private funds or the government-backed mortgage investment giants. They bought up the proceeds from pools of mortgages that get packaged up in the form of these securities. Mm-hmm. Now, the financial industry calls it a putback when the bank or the lending institution is forced to buy back the mortgage-backed security at face value, essentially give a refund to the investors who bought it, because there was something faulty about the way it was issued or sold.
Okay, so make the connection for me then between the foreclosure slowdown that we've been hearing about the past couple of weeks, all these paperwork problems, and this developing problem of the mortgage bond market.
Well, this logjam focused the spotlight on the problem of faulty documentation of these mortgages, and we all know that's thrown a wrench into the foreclosure process. But analysts are saying this putback problem goes beyond that, because we're not just talking about people not making their mortgage payments. We're talking about whether the banks can be held liable for misrepresentation or fraud for those bonds, and if they'll be on the hook for tens of billions of dollars in these putbacks. Already, Bank of America has paid out more than $3.3 billion to settle claims stemming from faulty underwriting or documentation.
All right, so they're paying out some money, but they are also saying out of the other side of their mouths, listen, this is simply a paperwork drill. We will fix this. There will be no problem with the bond market. Trust us, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll tell you what the investors are saying. Mm. I'll see you in court. There are some very big private investors who are pressing the issue. There's a report out today that the big bond investment firm PIMCO, the private equity firm BlackRock, and even the Federal Reserve Bank of New York are demanding the return of $47 billion from Bank of America's countrywide financial unit. Now, B of H Chief Brian Moynihan has likened this to a war, and during his conference call with analysts today, he argued the bulk of these mortgage-backed securities is not faulty.
Our perspective on this, we're going to be quite diligent defending the interests of our shareholders. This really gets down to a loan-by-loan determination, and we believe the resources to deploy against that kind of a review.
Translation, we can drag this out in the courts if we have to.
Yeah. All right. While they're doing that, is there a way for us to know what is coming? Is this the next version of the credit crisis? How much will this cost the banks? I mean, all of those questions.
Mm-hmm. That really is the multi-billion dollar question at this point. Analysts for a couple of those too-big-to-fail banks have put the likely price tag around $55 billion, stretched out over many years, they say. In the worst case, though, a few other analysts say it could end up costing the banks more than $100 billion. And as for what it means to us, we're already seeing a new tightening up of credit. People in the industry tell us loan originators are starting to worry that more loans are going to come bouncing back to them, so they're toughening up their underwriting standards, and this could make it even tougher to qualify for a mortgage now.
Marketplace's Bob Moon with the latest on the two-headed foreclosure crisis. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
So as I was saying, B of A lost $7.3 billion in the third quarter. Most of that came from a write-down on the value of its credit card unit. Banks just aren't going to be able to make as much off consumer plastic in the wake of new financial regulations. So B of A says it's going to work on bringing in more retail business instead of charging big fees to existing customers. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to explain how banks are going to make money in a post-overdraft charge world.
There will still be overdraft charges. They just won't be as lucrative as they used to be. Aaron Fine works in the retail banking practice at Oliver Wyman, the consulting firm. He says post-financial regulation, there are a couple ways banks can make up for the lost revenue.
They can convince customers to pay different kinds of fees. They can gather more relationship, or they can reduce the cost.
Banks are just starting to figure out what their new business models will look like. The trick is to find products and services that customers actually want. Retail banking isn't about having lots of branches anymore.
I think one of the ideas that people are clearly exploring is, well, what is convenience related to the new way that consumers access and spend their cash? And a lot of that, I think, has to do with, you know, with obviously electronic payments.
Banks are experimenting with letting customers make deposits from their cell phones and offering online tools to help them manage their money better. Jim Reichbach looks at financial institutions for Deloitte. He says the key is going to be all about building broader relationships, trying to convince us to have our checkings and savings accounts, credit cards, and mortgages all from one place.
They're going to be much more aggressive and reward customers for doing a full set of services. It's by having a more holistic relationship with people like you and I and others where they're providing all our services so they know us better and they can offer better pricing for that bundled package, if I may.
He says that could mean customers with a checking account get a better rate on a credit card or easier access to credit. Bank of America says it's started offering new products already, better rates to customers who do most of their banking online or at ATMs. And it'll start testing more perks soon as it tries to rebuild its customers' trust and generate new business. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
A lot of money left stocks today, in part thanks to our word of the day. It had to go someplace, and the bond market was as good a place as any. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to take a couple of minutes now, do some Freakonomics Radio with Stephen Dubner, co-author of the book and host of the podcast of the same name. Dubner, how are you?
Hey, Kai. So I want to try something different today, a bit of a quiz. You up for that?
Not without some reservations, but all right.
So let's just try this. I'm going to play you some voices on tape talking about different ways to experiment and innovate. I want you to try to guess who's talking.
Yeah, nobody told me there was going to be a test.
I'm telling you right now, don't worry, you're going to do fine.
You remember that dream you had when you were a kid about winding up in school in your underwear?
I wound up actually fully naked, so I didn't even have the underwear.
That's an entirely different show. But anyway, go ahead.
Let's get back on topic. Here's your first voice, Kai, all right? I'm going to tell you this man's first name. It's Peter. But you have to tell me, what kind of business do you think Peter is involved in?
You know, if I was a betting man, I may not have bet on the winner, and I may have lost all my money. But by backing a prize, you, in fact, support an entire ecosystem, an industry, all these approaches being tried. And the best one or best ones bubble to the top.
Oh, he's horse racing. Definitely horse racing.
Excellent guess, but very wrong. It's actually Peter Diamandis, who runs the XPRIZE Foundation, which tries to solve all kinds of problems, curing AIDS, predicting earthquakes, getting commercial spaceflight going. It runs intense competitions with multi-million dollar prizes for the winners. So, for instance, the XPRIZE Foundation just recently awarded $10 million to three teams who each invented a car that can travel 100 miles on a gallon of gas, or the equivalent of a non-gas fuel.
Right.
Here's the next voice, okay? This voice belongs to an engineer, a guy named Craig Neville Manning, and I'm going to tell you where he works, okay?
Yep.
He works for Google. Now, my question for you, Kai, is this. What kind of Google experiment do you think Craig is talking about right here?
It's really a way for our engineers to come up with a creative idea and then put that idea into practice. I feel like lots of ideas that people have, most of them are bad, and you never find that out until you actually try to put them into practice.
Oh, I have no earthly idea. Google, I mean, literally, it could be anything, right?
It could be anything. And what he's describing is what they call 20% time.
Oh, yeah.
Which means that Google allows or actually encourages its engineers to take 20% of their work time, or the equivalent of one day a week,
right,
to work on their own pet projects, all right?
Yep.
Now, how would you do if you had a full free day a week?
Well, I'd be home because I would take a free day.
Exactly. At Google, though, it's not just loafing around, I can assure you. So 20% time bears real and profitable fruit. Gmail and Google News, for instance.
Right.
Now let me play you one more. This All is right. someone who's sort of combining what we just heard from Google and what we know about the XPRIZE. Now, I want you to tell me who this is, Kai, and what you think this guy does.
Well, we're fundamentally trying to change the business we're in, and we're trying to drive innovation rather than being this compliance, you know, driven bureaucracy. And the idea of crowdsourcing that you're seeing in other industries, we think is absolutely applicable here. And the only way you challenge the status quo is to give people rewards for success.
Yeah, so that was what, like a gimme? That's Arne Duncan. He's the Secretary of Education.
Nicely done. And the reason I'm playing you this tape is because Duncan, in the Obama administration, has launched this program called Race to the Top, which is trying to give states a lot of money from their education departments if they can come up with experimental ways to innovate. Okay? Now, here's what I really like about Race to the Top.
Wait. I have the quiz answer. It goes like this. This is, if you roll Google and the XPRIZE and Arne Duncan, the government, all into one, it's all about government not being like government, right? Government being like business?
Gold star for Kai Rizdal. That's exactly right. So we're getting a lot of experimentation in the means of competition. And this fall, we're already seeing some payoff. Schools in winning states are gathering new data to help them track each student's progress from year to year. Delaware, one of the Race to the Top winners, has set up an experimental office to measure teacher skill with the goal of figuring out what makes a great teacher and then learning how to recruit more of them. So the government is acting a bit like a venture capital firm, right? Placing bets on a lot of different ideas, many of which are bound to fail. But that's kind of the point. Fail hard, fail fast, and let the winning ideas rise to the top. So, Kai, remember this. The reason Charles Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic Ocean was to win a cash prize, $25,000, all right?
Mm-hmm.
When I asked Peter Diamandis of the XPRIZE Foundation what all of us got for that prize money, he had a very simple answer: the aviation industry.
Stephen Dubner and Freakonomics Radio. He's back in a couple of weeks with more. In the meanwhile, check his website for the blog and the podcast and all that good stuff that he's doing. It's freakonomicsradio.com. Dubner, we'll see you.
Thanks a million, Kai.
And now, let's do the numbers. Those worries about Bank of America and mortgage putbacks we told you about earlier? Oh yeah, they put the cement shoes on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials dropped 165 points, about 1.5%, finished at 10,978. The NASDAQ off 43 points, 1.75%, settled at 2,436. The S&P 500 gave back 18 points, more than 1.5%, ended things at 1,165. Shares of B of A slumped more than 4% on concern the bank might have to buy back billions in troubled mortgages. Other financial stocks closed mixed today. J.P. Morgan Chase slipped 1.33%. Goldman Sachs added nearly 2% today. Despite profit gains of 70%, investors soured on Apple's quarterly earnings. Shares rotted 2.75% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, with financial professionals nationwide who are trained to serve the unique financial needs of their clients at massmutual.com. By Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book summary of current economic conditions. The national debt is the focus of a discussion at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And the United Nations marks its first ever World Statistics Day, celebrating the many contributions and achievements of official statistics. Make it count. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
And write them you did. We will begin this week in Toronto, from whence we told you the story of one big hotel chain's efforts to save water by guests not only reusing towels, but refusing housekeepers' offers to clean the rooms. Maids and their unions complained about what that's doing to their jobs. Philip Prindeville complained about what it was doing to our reporting.
This piece is one-sided. It doesn't ask the question of whether in a receding economy should a business be looking for ways to cut their operating costs and maybe lower their prices so that cash-strapped customers can still afford their services.
Our story last week about abandoned Indian brides struck a chord with a lot of you. It's the practice of Indian families marrying their daughters off to Indian men living overseas, some of whom then take off after some sort of dowry is paid, conveniently. Krishna Prasad says we only told half the story.
Did you check about the guys who were supposed to be a runaway? Did you at least make an attempt to find one? Have you ever thought that men are also victims on this?
I sat down with Elmore Leonard last week to talk about his new book, Djibouti. It's about Somali pirates. He described them as being high on cot. That's a narcotic that makes them, in his words, a little crazy. Michael Kolodner gave us our drug refresher.
The effects of the mildly narcotic shrub Caffa edulis, or cot, are simply not as dramatic as Mr. Leonard implied. Chewing cot makes you alert and focused, not to mention talkative. You could equally refer to all American workers as being high on caffeine from their coffee.
Finally, texting while driving. I did an interview about smartphone apps that let drivers use their voices, not their thumbs, to get their text messages across. We tested an app on the air called Vlingo, and it was less than perfect. The CEO of Vlingo heard that interview and wrote to say it might have worked better if we had played with it a little bit more and practiced before we went on the radio. He said a lot of people have used Vlingo safely, as many as 50 million times, so fair enough. If you have something you want to say, please don't do it while you're driving. Email us at marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Tricky as it can be to reason with teenagers, most of them see the benefits of staying in high school until they graduate. Those who do eventually wind up dropping out, though, start showing signs of it as early as sixth grade. So what if you got right down to it and just paid those kids to keep coming to class? Now, cash incentives in and of themselves aren't new, but a program in Baltimore has taken it one step further, letting kids play the markets. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports.
In Mr. Lewis's science classroom at the Barclay School in Baltimore, an air conditioner hums mercifully in the corner, fighting the unseasonable heat. Posters cheerfully promote rocks and minerals and the atom. But today's lesson will be a little less scientific.
Has anybody ever heard of stocks before? So flip the lights on for me now. Stocks. Stocks. Anybody ever heard of stocks?
The program is called Stocks in the Future. Over the course of the year, these sixth graders will get paid to go to school. Rather than pocket the money, they'll invest it in stocks they help pick. When they graduate from high school and turn 18, the stock is theirs. 10-year-old Kayla Jackson says it sounds like a pretty good deal.
I like it because it gives kids the chance to earn their own money instead of trying to go out there and find a job when it's much dangerous. It's more dangerous now than it was back in the day.
It's not much money. Students earn a dollar for every week of perfect attendance throughout middle school, more for good grades.
They're getting more than just money. They're getting something that is a life skill.
Renard Lewis is well-suited to teach them. Before he became a teacher, he worked as a financial advisor at Raymond James. Today's lesson, opportunity cost, the price of giving up one thing for something else. To explain, Mr. Lewis talks about the sacrifices some students made to study for a quiz.
So, although I want to play PlayStation 3, Although I want to watch SpongeBob. Oh, don't act like y'all don't watch SpongeBob. Oh, y'all, Alan, you know you still watch SpongeBob, man. See, you seeing that, all right? Although you want to do those things, you know the most important thing is getting the best possible grade you can get on Mr. Lewis's quiz, right?
So these kids are fighting tough odds. By one count, more than half of public school students in Baltimore don't earn a diploma, and the warning signs show up early. Studies have shown that sixth graders who miss a lot of class are much more likely to drop out. Pat Bernstein founded Stocks in the Future with Johns Hopkins University. She says students in the program attend more school and score higher on aptitude tests. She says the money isn't just an incentive for a student to show up in class or study.
Almost more importantly, it gives her an excuse among her peers for doing things that she would like to do but could get pressured into not doing unless she had a reason. We give them that reason.
Incentives and excuses make Garrett Duncan uncomfortable. He teaches education and African American studies at Washington University in St. Louis.
They reinforce certain stereotypes about certain communities, poor and working class students, Black and Latino students, that they need some kind of carrot in front of them to do what other students normally do.
Stocks can also be a hard sell these days. Teacher Jay Valentine says it was especially tough during the financial crisis.
I actually had a kid say, well, why are we even studying this? Because stocks are over.
But when stocks recover, there's a lesson in that, too.
You talk to them about the ups and downs and try to give them this idea that, you know, one person's trash is another person's treasure.
In Mr. Lewis's class, the kids are getting the hang of opportunity cost. He asks what they might do instead of going to the movies.
Give me some thoughts of what you could do with 2 hours of your time back and $25. Yes.
Go buy a movie and then go get yourself some McDonald's.
Okay,
it's hard to know if stocks in the future will actually change graduation rates. Out of the 200 students who've gone through the program and reached graduation age, only 28 have shown up to claim their portfolios so far. If this latest crop of students invests smartly, they could do pretty well. Years ago, some of Mr. Lewis's students bought Netflix stock at $20 a share. It's now trading at around $150. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Technology is one of those words that can mean what you want it to mean. Context is everything. And we treat it almost as if it's human sometimes. Kevin Kelly is a longtime observer of technology, how humans interact with it, and vice versa as well. His new book is called What Technology Wants. Kevin, good to have you here.
My pleasure.
It's worth pointing out as we start this discussion that you yourself, the guy who helped start Wired Magazine, who's been involved in technology for a long time, your relationship with technology is what you might fairly call conflicted.
Yeah, we don't have television at our house. Our kids grew up without it. I don't have a smartphone. I don't have a laptop. I ride my bike more than I drive. But then at the same time, you know, Wired, cool tools, all this kind of stuff, it all flows through.
So you can't live with it, you can't live without it, right?
That's exactly true. We are both the masters of technology and the slaves to it. And the technium, all this stuff, it has its own agenda.
Yeah. Define that term for me, technium. You use it to sort of be all-encompassing of the world of technology.
Yeah, well, let's take your little phone in your pocket. There are probably about 1,000 different technologies that are required to make that. That whole thing, that whole interdependency, is what I call the technium. It's kind of like a lifelike force.
We tend to take technology to mean one very specific thing in this day and age. It's all about digital and the internet and new gadgets. But you start us on this voyage in your book with stone tools and arrowheads. I mean, technology has a spanning definition.
We tend to think of technology as anything that was invented after we were born. I think the first technology was the invention of language. And, of course, once we invented language, it began to transform us and change us. And we invented cooking, and cooking changed our bodies. It changed our teeth and jaws. And so we have been remaking ourselves with our own inventions. So we, I think, are the first domesticated animal. Humans are the first domesticated animal.
Do we have power, though, over technology?
That is the question. Have we made something that we're no longer masters of? And I think to some extent, yes. In the book, What Technology Wants, I talk about how the Unabomber was right. And what he was right about was the fact that this thing, this technium, has its own agenda. What he was wrong about was the fact that you need to kill people about it, or that it was taking away our freedoms, when in fact the technium is actually bringing us new choices and possibilities. We do have an obligation to increase the amount of technology in the world.
Who's the obligation to? Our coming generations?
Yes. Every new technology is a possibility that would allow somebody's gifts and abilities to prosper and be expressed. Imagine if Beethoven had been born before the in technologies of the piano or the symphony. What a loss that would have been.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great image of Beethoven without the technology of the piano. But at the same time, I think to myself, yeah, but why does my 12-year-old need a cell phone that he can text with his friends, right?
Yeah, but see, for him, this is not technology. This is just the environment, the background. And there are negative things. There are problems. But the solution to any problem from technology is not less technology, but more technology. Just as the solution to a bad idea is not to stop thinking, it's to have a better idea.
Kevin Kelly helped start Wired Magazine. He ran it for a number of years. He runs a great website called Cool Tools, and he's got a new book out. It's called What Technology Wants. Kevin, thanks a lot.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note on the way out this afternoon. We started today with Bank of America and its earnings. The country's biggest bank has set aside more than $5 billion to guard against credit losses. What we didn't mention is that Goldman Sachs reported profits today, too, with their own set aside, $3.8 billion. Of course, theirs is for compensation, you know, being Goldman Sachs and all. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday. Today, the Dow dropped 165 points, about 1.5%, finished at 10,978. The NASDAQ off 43 points, 1.75%, settled at 2436. The S&P 500 gave back 18 points, more than 1.5%. Ended things at 1165. Thanks today to our Morning Report crew of Doug Krisner and Sonata Lee. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this program, I scream, you scream, landlords with empty commercial space scream for frozen yogurt.
If you've got long-term plans for your building, but you need a tenant to come in, frozen yogurt's perfect. It's just not fantastic long-term.
Who knew? I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.